A newspaper man takes home a book award. At a time when both the news business and the book business face crisis, a celebration provides welcome diversion. And in reviews, the late Ray Bradbury seems to haunt a new novel from Edgar Award winner Robert Jackson Bennett. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and each week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of news that everyone in publishing will be talking about. Joining me from the offices of PW is Andrew Albanese, magazine's senior writer. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, indeed, the National Book Awards were held just earlier this week, and what was the news from that?
Yeah, so congratulations to the 2012 winners. As you say, they were announced at a ceremony here on Wednesday evening. The winners included William Alexander for Goblin Secrets in the Young People's Literature category, David Ferry in the poetry category for his book Bewilderment, Catherine Boot for Behind Beautiful Forevers in nonfiction, and in what seems to be something of a very popular choice, Louise Erdrich took home the fiction honors for The Roundhouse. Erdrich, it's worth noting, has made just about every list that's come out so far, including PW's Best Books and the list contributed by our contributing editor, Nancy Pearl, in last week's PW. And as you mentioned in your intro, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. from the New York Times received the Literarian Award for Outstanding Service to the American Literary Community. You know, since taking the reins as publisher of the Times in 1992, I believe, the paper's racked up just under 50, I think 46 was the number, 46 Pulitzer Prizes. And it was definitely some good news given the fate of book coverage in so many American newspapers. Sulzberger said last night or on Wednesday that that books are and will continue to be a pillar of the newspaper's brand and coverage. So that was fantastic to hear. As long as restaurant critic Pete Wells doesn't start doing book reviews, I think publishers can breathe a sigh of relief over that. And also Elmore Leonard was presented with the Medical for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. If you haven't already seen the news and read it on the PW website, you can do so. And in Monday's issue, we'll have a complete roundup, including photos from the ceremony.
Well, you know, I read actually in the Times account, Andrew, that Terry Gross was the presenter for the award to Sulzberger, and she referred to the Times Book Review as like a shopping catalog that alerted her to authors I've overlooked, obviously authors important to NPR. I hope she's reading Publishers Weekly as well.
Oh, I'm sure she is.
All right. Well, it's always nice to have some good news and to celebrate books. But the industry, as we all know, is in the throes of some major changes. And we've got the Authors Guild returning to court with an appeal over a recent decision against it in a lawsuit on library scanning. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. So late last week, the Authors Guild filed notice that it has appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Harold Baer's October 10th summary judgment, which tossed the Authors Guild's case against HathiTrust. Now, we're still waiting for the exact nature of the appeal, but we can imagine that the issues that are going to be up for review are going to be pretty broad, because in a statement at the time of Baer's decision, the Guild said that it had disagreed with pretty much every aspect of Baer's ruling. So you can check out the PW website, because we're certainly going to be following this as we learn more about the appeal. But right now, it's setting up to be a pretty fascinating episode in this litigation, and I can just offer you a few general observations. First, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago here, there's a standing issue in Judge Baer's ruling that's almost certainly going to be appealed. As our listeners might recall, Judge Baer found that the Authors Guild did not qualify for associational standing because of statutory reasons. Simply put, Copyright Act, only allows for legal and beneficial copyright owners to sue for copyright infringement. So everyone else, Baer ruled, including the Authors Guild, are excluded. Now, certainly the Guild wants to see that reversed, although there is some debate as to whether or not this is really all that vital. You know, someone who I respect greatly, Cornell University's Peter Hurdle, made a very convincing argument to me at the recent In Re Books conference that this really was probably of very little consequence in practice. And I think Peter's right. You know, the Guild historically doesn't sue people for copyright infringement. Still, I've talked to a few lawyers, and they've said that the ruling kind of does put a dent in the Guild's armor. First and foremost, because it isn't only about being able to sue and win. It's about the perception that you might be able to sue and win. In other words, those who may have been dissuaded from undertaking some kind of bold digitization program for fear of crossing swords with a well-funded or at least a better-funded organization may be a little less worried about, you know, proceeding on some new initiative if their only worry is whether or not a test case was going to be brought by an individual author. So I think that's definitely an issue that's going to be brought up on the appeal. But what's really interesting to me here, and, you know, I'm the kind of geek that likes to talk about copyright at parties, is that the Second Circuit is already reviewing the Guild's class action certification in its other case against Google. So in essence, we now have two cases before separate appeals panels at the Second Circuit who are going to be addressing somewhat similar issues. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how or if these two cases intersect on any of these standing issues. But of that, of course, is all a sideshow when it comes to this appeal, because the main questions are certainly going to revolve around the, you know, emphatic finding of fair use by Judge Baer. You know, first, whether or not libraries can even raise a fair use defense, which the Authors Guild argued they could not. And second, Baer's application of the four-factor analysis of fair use. Now, remember, on appeal, they don't present any new evidence. And based on the evidence we've seen so far, this case really wasn't even close for Baer. In fact, Baer wrote that he couldn't imagine a definition of fair use that would force him to shut down the HathiTrust corpus. But what I'm going to be paying particular attention to is how the Authors Guild attorneys very delicately make the case that the access that, you know, this decision enabled for the print disabled and for scholarly preservation and all these other uses should be taken away. I think that's going to be a very, very high wire for them to cross.
Well, indeed, interesting analysis there. And you mentioned the two appeals going to the Second Circuit. Now, if I understand copyright law, and I've only hung around copyright lawyers here at Copyright Clearance Center for about 10 years, each case is sui generis. Each case is its own. And so it's entirely possible that two very diverging decisions could be made.
That's right. You know, one of the interesting things about this too, we're used to having disagreements between circuits, you know, different court circuits wind up going to the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting to see if we get disagreements within the Second Circuit here.
Well, indeed. And you know, you mentioned that you're a geek at about copyrighted parties. Well, that makes you our kind of geek here at Copyright Clearance Center. Listen, we'll be talking some more this weekend. You and I will see each other and hopefully some of our listeners at the Miami Book Fair, where we'll be doing a panel on Saturday.
That's right. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit. Maybe Google, maybe the DOJ pricing and ebooks and DRM and e-readers and reviews and all kinds of things that are affecting and of interest to readers in the book world. So, you know, I'm really excited. This is my first trip to the Miami Book Fair, which is, you know, fabled as one of the great book fairs in the country. So everybody talks about what a great show it is. So I'm very interested and very happy to be there. But what I'm really interested in is the panel that you're going to be doing later that afternoon on self-publishing, because I think that's an enormous issue that a lot of people are going to be interested in.
Well, indeed, we expect a crowd for that, if only because Miami Herald reporter Carlos Harrison covered the whole self-publishing subject extensively in the Sunday paper this week. And we'll tell people briefly about that panel and our own. So at 4:30 on Saturday, November 17th, I'll be moderating a panel on self-publishing that will feature Jenny Pedroza, a co-founder of the Writers Coffee Shop, the original publishers of 50 Shades of Grey, Matt Kavner, a vice president at Vook, Mark Coker, founder of Smashwords, and MJ Rose, who's author of What to Do Before Your Book Launch. She's also the author of multiple best-selling books and published her first ebook in 1999. So somebody who's been there for a while. That's at 4:30 on Saturday. At 11 o'clock in the morning, Andrew will join me for On the Book Beat. We're going to meet the reporters who cover the book business. Joining Andrew Albanese, the senior writer at Publishers Weekly, will be Alan Chews, well known to our listeners, I'm sure, as the voice of books on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. That panel takes place at 11 a.m. Both of those are in Building 8, which if you find out about Miami-Dade College, you know all the buildings have numbers rather like Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Anyway, Andrew Albanese, we look forward to seeing you this weekend in Miami, and you take care. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville. Welcome to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Nice to have you back, and we've got some interesting books this week. You'll start off with fiction.
That's right. In fiction this week, we have a profile of Kent Harif, who almost three decades after his first novel, The Tie That Binds, is back with Benediction. And this novel, like most of his work, is set in the high plains of eastern Colorado where he lives. So that's not technically in the reviews section, but if you pick up the magazine, you'll find it with the rest of the features. In the reviews, we have a Q&A with Ned Bowman, whose new book, The Teleportation Accident, was longlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize. Bowman talks about the influence of Mike Davis's leftist history of Los Angeles, City of Courts, and about basing one of the characters in his new novel on James N. Cain, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Bowman says it's such a visceral and convincing novel that when he read it, he assumed Cain himself must have been a self-taught writer with a criminal past. The River Swimmer contains two novellas by Jim Harrison. The title novella finds a young man badly beaten by his girlfriend's father swimming 100 miles to Chicago. He takes up with a new woman there and travels with her to France, where he's injured again while swimming the Loire River. In the land of unlikeness, a 60-year-old college professor, divorced for two decades, uses a forced 3-month leave from his professorship at an Ivy League university in New York to return to Michigan so he can care for his aging mother and rekindle an old romantic relationship. Fans of Harrison will know that he's been doing a lot of work with novellas lately, so this is continuing that trend. We also review East German author Christa Wolf's City of Angels, or The Overcoat of Dr. Freud. This was published in German in 2010, a year before the author's death, and is the autobiographical story of Wolf's time in 1992 as a resident scholar at Los Angeles' Getty Institute. Wolf navigates depression, guilt, anger, and Los Angeles, home of prior generations of German refugees and émigrés, and we get an insider's view of the fall of the Berlin Wall and reunification, complete as such views are, with drop details and omitted linkages that create more confusion and more interest. Though the book is slow at times, PW's reviewer says it's worth it to see Wolf grappling with a past that, far from being dead, is live like ammunition.
Wow, what an image, live like ammunition. In mystery and thrillers, another familiar name should ring a bell with people.
That's right. Charlie Memminger's first novel, Aloha Lady Blue, will appeal to fans of John D. MacDonald. It introduces former investigative reporter Stryker McBride, who lives in Hawaii, aboard a luxury houseboat called the Travis McGee. And the action opens as Stryker nurses along his first meal of the day, which he likes to refer to as honey bunches of Budweiser, because that sounds healthier than swigging beer for breakfast. Also, Conan Doyle fans will appreciate the Holmes and Watson-like relationship in A Study in Revenge. This is Kiernan Shields' second historical, and the relationship is between Percival Gray, who's half Abenaki Indian, and Deputy Archie Lean of the Portland, Maine Police. In a macabre twist, the burned body of a murder victim turns up after its burial in an abandoned house adorned with drawings of Satan and the message, Hell Awaits. And also in the mystery and thriller section, we have a Q&A with Oliver Putsch, author of The Beggar King, who talks about being a descendant of a long line of professional executioners in Bavaria.
Well, yeah. That's professional executioners. What a family business to be in.
I'm just impressed that they made it to a long line.
That's right. In science fiction, a book that reminds some readers of Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, this is American Elsewhere, the fourth novel by Robert Jackson Bennett. His second book won the Edgar Award, and his third book, The Troop, was on PW's Best Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror list for 2012. In this title, an ex-cop learns that she has inherited a house from her long-dead mother, and she travels to a small town near a government research site where the facade of normalcy conceals some very dark secrets. It's creepy, it's funny, and it's very, very American. Our review calls the novel part Bradbury and part Lengle with a dash of Edward Scissorhands. We also cover Kalumpura. This is the third book in Jay Lake's Green fantasy series. Green is 16 years old, a former courtesan and assassin, and now the mother of twins. She's trying to settle down with the kids, but keeps getting drawn into unfinished business, which makes her the target of gods and other old enemies. Our reviewer says thoughtful fantasy readers will appreciate the sheer audacity of a killer, bisexual, non-white teen mom protagonist. I guess that is not something you see every day.
Indeed not. In romance, a storm hits Brooklyn, but not Sandy.
Well, Robin Kay launches the Bad Boys of Red Hook contemporary series with Back to You, in which old flames reunite in one of Brooklyn's poorest neighborhoods. Storm Decker left Red Hook in the middle of the night, leaving behind a heartbroken, furious Brianna Collins, and now Storm is back to care for his ailing foster father, but it's hard for Brianna to believe he can love anyone other than himself. Now, obviously, Kay, when she named her protagonist Storm, and Brianna's nickname is Breezy. I mean, we go all out here. She could not have known that Red Hook would make the national news after being devastated by Hurricane Sandy. But readers who've been hearing the name Red Hook and trying to visualize the neighborhood will certainly appreciate the strong sense of place in her novel. And also in the romance section, Ann Barton's debut, When She Was Wicked, smartly blends issues of morality and Regency-era social class with passion and excitement. A blackmailing seamstress is caught by one of her intended victims. Instead of turning her in, he turns the tables, extorting wardrobes from her for his sisters. As they grow closer, her secrets haunt them both. And the PW Review says that sensual and solid, this debut is a story demanding to be read. In the religion section this week, The Oldest Bedtime Story Ever is a gorgeous retelling for children by Benjamin Morse, an artist and academic. And Morse's retelling of the Bible starts with creation and journeys into the promised land and beyond, using mixed media collages to illustrate the stories. The book is also available digitally, and the book's publisher, Orson & Company, calls its digital books e-looms, as in illuminated manuscripts, that are designed to be an antidote to the impersonal nature of digital reading.
Well, from the impersonal in religion, we can turn to nonfiction with some lovely reviews.
That's right. Yeah, we have a special group of boxed reviews of books for every Valentine contingency, from making up to breaking up, and from loving online to loving what's on the inside. Some examples. In her breezy book, Little Book of Heartbreak, Megan Laslucky collects tales of history's greatest love affairs gone awry and offers advice from music, science, and personal experience. According to her bio, she's been dumped at least a dozen times, including on her birthday. So she tells readers how to get over the end of an affair. The numerous stories of folks who survived love lends credit to her view of heartbreak as transformative and reminds readers that though they may be lonely, they are certainly not alone. Also, in Data, A Love Story, Amy Webb, a compulsively organized journalist and digital strategist, takes readers on an insightful and funny journey through online dating as she tries to find the perfect man by putting herself in his shoes. In an elaborate masquerade, she creates a fake online dating profile as a man to discover what kind of woman seduces Mr. Right. Webb's advice for dating both on and offline is insightful and data-driven, and her descriptions of meddling family members, bad dates, and terrible profiles are hilarious, honest, and inspirational. Elsewhere in nonfiction, Americans cope with the fallout from 40 years of dwindling prospects in Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. It's a quietly harrowing mosaic of economic decline by journalist Barbara Garson, who wrote All the Livelong Day. She focuses on the basics, jobs, homes, money, and the people who have lost them since the 2008 financial crisis. And her vivid, shrewd, warmly sympathetic profiles show the resilience with which ordinary Americans respond to misfortune, but also the enduring costs as they abandon hopes for fulfilling careers, extra children, or secure retirement. This is a compelling portrait of an economy that has turned against the and faster spreading than the flu are the ordinary conversations people have about products and ideas, at least according to Contagious, Why Things Catch On, which is an infectious treatise on viral marketing. Wharton marketing professor Jonah Berger investigates all manner of phenomena, surging name brands, chic restaurants, YouTube hits, most emailed articles, the sort of thing that catches on through word-of-mouth popularity. And he writes in a sprightly, charming style that deftly delineates the intersection of cognitive psychology and social behavior with an eye toward helping business people and others spread their messages.
And finally, we round out the reviews with some books from the children's section.
Yeah, we have a review of Morris Sendak's final work, My Brother's Book. It's an ode to his late brother, Jack, who died in 1995, a somber story of one brother's search for the other. With multiple references to Shakespeare and Blake evident in the text and the artwork, as well as allusions to some of Sendak's earlier works, including We're All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy and Chicken Soup with Rice. It's an especially poignant work, given that it comes on the heels of Sendak's own death earlier this year. On the fiction side, we have a review of Navigating Early, the first book from Claire Vanderpool since her Newbery Medal-winning debut, Moon Over Manifest. There's definitely more of a boy focus in this story, set at the end of World War II, in which 13-year-old Jack acclimates to life at a Maine boarding school and befriends a focused and eccentric student named Early Auden. Early's obsession with the number pi leads both boys on a journey into the wilderness in a story that blends reality, fantasy, coincidence, and fate. And finally, our pick of the week for this week. In his compassionate, engaging first book, Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America, journalist Jeff Chu, a gay Christian who was raised Southern Baptist and wrestles with theology, spends a year interviewing Christians across America, asking the questions that have long frightened him. What Chu finds is, quote, a country that deeply wants to love, but is conflicted on how to do so. The book brings complexity and humanity to a discourse often lacking in both.
Sounds interesting indeed. Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, blogs at Genreville. Thank you for joining us this week. And we will remind viewers and wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. And that means we get next week off.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I am sure looking forward to that long weekend.
Absolutely. And the start of the holiday shopping season, too. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at Copyright Clearance Center's website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.